Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 18 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the poet and librettist Robin Bolam talks about roots, both geographical and emotional, and their importance in writing, and the Bulgarian poet, memoirist and novelist Capka Kasabova considers the nature of exile and where a writer can truly find home. First up, here's Robin.
Roots is the title of a self-portrait by the Mexican painter Frida Kahlo. In it, she lies on her home soil, with a vine growing out of her heart and over her body and down into the ground. This striking painting prompted me to question the origin of personal roots. How much are they due to the influence our homeland exerts over our lives, whether or not we welcome it, and to what extent do they come from within us, as a result of our affinity with and love of our birthplace? Finally, in order to keep connected, do we need to remain where we began? I once wrote a poem called Roots. Created in my 20s, as a response to a vivid and disturbing recurrent dream, I now realise that it is a poem about grieving, not only for my first home in the Tyne Valley, but also for places where I'd tried to settle subsequently. The poem begins, "Some nights I hear them digging in the foundations. The whole house echoes with the tap of roots, feeling their way in the darkness, trying to get in." As they grow older, people often search for their roots. But here, it appears that a young woman's roots are trying to find her. They follow from place to place, refusing to be jilted. The poem's language suggests a loving relationship, yet the speaker confesses that she dare not yield to their sinewy arms. She needs to keep moving from place to place, and, while she cannot settle permanently anywhere, she is unable to kill the urge to do so. In the final stanza, the roots enter the house. Unlike those that Kahlo painted, I see these as having come from many directions, from all the places where the speaker had once felt settled or had hoped to stay. She goes to meet them, takes a pick, smashes the floorboards, and discovers mandrakes. Frequently mentioned by Shakespeare and the other Jacobean dramatists I was studying at the time, mandragora was used as a sleeping potion, as well as a hallucinogen. This speaker yearns to sleep peacefully, but is disturbed by surreal events. Mandrake roots are branched, and when torn out of the ground, they make a sound which has been likened to screams. These were believed to kill whoever heard them. In my poem, the speaker pulls, smothers, and buries the misshapen roots in a drawer by her bed. Then she closes it on a harvest of stilled screams and sleeps. I had assumed I would stay on Tyneside, but when I married, circumstances quickly changed, and for a decade we moved house every 18 months or 2 years. When I wrote that early poem, which develops into an exorcism of a nightmare, I had no idea what my future would hold. Yet the conflict between a desire to settle permanently in one place and the inability to do this is at its heart. We write poetry for many reasons and draw on disparate influences. Here, my deep engagement with the world of Jacobean drama fused with a personal dilemma and a linked dream. We are also often haunted by the same themes throughout our writing lives. Sometimes writing poetry is an attempt to try to understand what has happened to us, to express emotions and the challenges we are struggling to overcome. Like the subject of survival, in its many contexts, the topic of roots continues to concern me, and in my writing, it has branched in a number of directions. The deaths of my parents, 20 years apart, caused me to lose the home my family had occupied, mainly as tenants, for over 200 years, and led me to commemorate them all in a poem entitled Raiding the Borders. In this, I reach back on my father's side to the time of the Reavers, who raided homesteads on the English-Scottish border. I trace, very roughly, the development of my own genealogical line, and use the metaphor of raiding borders to convey how it feels when people you love are stolen away by death in the dark months of winter. The poem explores what is involved when you live with borders of various kinds, geographical, physical, and spiritual. Awareness of your roots can be a reassuring anchor in the past, but it can also create a heavy sense of responsibility. My grandmother, like her father, ran the village post office and lived adjacent to it. Generation after generation passed on a tenancy until, just before my grandmother's death, she was able to buy the house and hand it down to my father. When I found myself with no practical option but to sell an old, loved cottage that needed to be lived in and maintained, I felt I had betrayed my ancestors and surrendered our home. At the end of the poem, in a dream, the five generations who had striven to keep the house their parents left them wave to me from the front path as I leave. Even though it is autobiographical, Raiding the Borders mentions a dream which did not exist. The poem describes not what I dreamt, but what I thought I saw when I left my family home for the last time. It was a fleeting glimpse, perhaps a trick of the mind, after studying old family photographs not long before, in which long-dead relatives, and some I had known, posed on the same path. Yet there are more figures in my recollection, still vivid to this day, than I ever saw in a photo, and they were, as the poem relates, walking down the path. Above all, I was left, perhaps through wishful thinking, with a strong sense of being absolved. This helped me to reach the last line of the poem. If we can't defend, we are forgiven. Later, a friend, the composer Bennett Hogg, told me that this final sentiment was understood and appreciated by a Bosnian companion during the 1992-5 war, who related Raiding the Borders to the dilemma of those forced to abandon their homes when they fled the fighting. Our situations were hardly comparable, but we shared an understanding of generational guilt and the strength of family roots. I learnt that, if the conveyed emotion is heartfelt, it may be able to cross borders of culture and context to offer comfort. We were all rooted once, however briefly, in our birthplace. I've learnt that whether we stay there or move on does not necessarily mean the difference between being rooted and being rootless. I never intended to move from Northumberland, so I see it as the home of a deep tap root. From this, a runner set off down the country to small Berkshire villages, moved on to Kent, then Yorkshire, where it reached from Wensleydale to York, before returning to Berkshire, stretching east to Greater London, up to northeast Scotland, and down to Hampshire. Despite the distance, through a complex network of routes, I feel that I remain connected to my Northumbrian origins, because, although not in quite the same way as in Carlo's portrait, my heart is involved in the rooting process. Yet at various times I have also been seen as a Berkshire, Canterbury rather than Kentish, Yorkshire, Southwest London, or Hampshire poet, and was glad to be included in an anthology of Scottish women poets because of two poems in which I explore the roots of a character, Shakespeare's Lady Macbeth, whose original name was Gruach. One of these poems is in Old Scots dialect, my version of the historical figure's voice. Shakespeare isn't usually associated with Scotland or Northumberland, but he is the writer who gave me a sense of literary roots, which was first revealed to me by a gentle northeast voice. My grandmother lived with us when I was a child. She was often confined to bed because of a heart condition, but she could summon Shakespeare's characters into the room. Vivid dialogue, related from memory and sometimes perfectly quoted, was embellished with a few personal details of her own. Tucked up against her mock Jacobean headboard, we found ourselves in the Forest of Arden, Verona, Cyprus, or Macbeth's castle. Sometimes Robin Hood or Robbie Burns, both heroes of my father, made brief guest appearances. I discovered that Shakespeare was fun, and that he invited you to play with his characters and ideas just as he had himself taken liberties with his source material. When she was still active, my grandmother played the piano and taught me songs which featured characters such as Cushy Butterfield, who would have been quite at home in a Shakespearean scene. These were the only stories I remember being told as a preschool child. When she died, my grandmother left me her collection of Tyneside songs, a tissue-paged complete works of Shakespeare, and a love of varieties of language that has never diminished. About this time, in the early 1960s, I started travelling to school in Newcastle by train. Although I did not know it, I took the same route as Basil Bunting, who valued the oral traditions of the Northeast and wrote that poetry, like music, was to be heard. He lived in the village of Wylam, the next stop down the line. I love to think that one day we caught the same train as he finished his best-known long poem, Brig Flats, which he reputedly completed on this journey. I didn't know anything about him, including what he looked like, until I was much older. If I had seen a mustachioed, bespectacled man in his 60s scribbling away, I wouldn't have automatically assumed he was writing his wonderful poem of fells and rain, or silently, in his head, rolling the R's of rag mats, ragged lettuces, and the rocks where men killed Bloodaxe, Northumbria's last independent king. Even if I'd realised who Bunting was and what he was writing, I would have been too shy to approach him. Besides, being questioned by an unknown child was probably the last thing he needed. Yet to have possibly shared a handful of the same soil as a literary legend, however briefly or unawares, is still an inspiring thought. Bunting was born and died in the Northeast, but in the central part of his life he travelled to Iran and elsewhere. Brig Flats was crafted after his return to the area, and for me part of the poem's great strength lies in the way he places his celebration of the North at the centre of a much bigger span, which stretches across the globe and up to the stars. I feel that we each have several landscapes, the one we see out of the window wherever we travel, the landscape of our imagination, which has no boundaries in our minds, and our memory of a native landscape, preserved with love, which identifies us with a place and its culture. For years, I dreamed of returning to live in Northumberland, but having grown up looking to the northernmost English border, I find myself now on one of the most southerly. My family was firmly rooted geographically, and, returning to my initial pondering, I feel that my roots keep hold of me even when I travel away from them. In Australia, the farthest I've been from home, I felt close to Newcastle when I climbed the Tyne Bridge's magnified mirror image in Sydney Harbour on the eve of 9/11. This inspired me to bring the bridges together as part of a wider prospect in my poem Something Bigger. Since I left the Northeast, changes have transformed it, but there is much to celebrate. The view across the valley still lifts my heart, even though these days I see it from my parents' hillside grave rather than our former home. When I return, I notice old sights in new ways. Although most of my friends and remaining family are elsewhere, a strong bond remains. Where I live now, I miss the moors and high wild places, a sense of the rural in a small industrial town, my old city port, the view across the valley. But strangely, I've found the perspective I need to be able to focus more clearly on my old home, and by fusing memory with fresh observation, write about it again.
That was Robin Bolam, recorded by Julia Copus. You can find out more about Robin on her website at www.robinbolam.com. That's Robin with a Y. Next, here's Kapka Kasubova.
People always ask, where are you from? Or, the more culturally permissive, where is home? The two questions are on the surface quite different. One is about the past, the other about the present. One is about origins, the other about choice. But they worry me in the same way, because I have always, since childhood, longed to be elsewhere. So where do you belong? People want to know. Where is your place? Where is my place? I wondered, aged 8, as I stayed up late reading Scarlet Sails by Alexander Green. It's the story of a girl waiting for a mythical ship with scarlet sails to appear and take her away. Green's escapist stories were set in places with fantastical names, which is why you wouldn't guess that he never made it out of Soviet Russia. I stood on our concrete balcony on the outskirts of communist Sofia and surveyed the thousands of lit-up squares of high-rises. Not a scarlet sail in sight. Tinkling with trams and punctuated by Orthodox churches, the Sofia of my childhood lived in the shadow of chestnut trees and late totalitarianism. It held onto its Belle Epoque remains under the onslaught of brutalist architecture and big-fisted proletarian monuments that very soon became chipped, just like our block 328, where my sister, me, and my mathematician parents lived as normally as we could. We had a Škoda, and my father spent weekends lying under it, while my mother made birthday cakes without flour, milk, or sugar. From where I stood on the chipped balcony of block 328, the world was coloured patches in the atlas, radiostatic. Something that happened in books. The trick was to imagine that you were somewhere else, somewhere in the pages of, say, Pushkin's Eugene Onegin and Jack London's Call of the Wild. In other words, you learnt to practice internal emigration, which meant that in your head you were somewhere else. Then the Berlin Wall suddenly fell. And in the rubble of the Cold War, our family was catapulted in an unexpected direction, the West, or rather, down under, where an academic job materialized for my father. Now, in my atlas, New Zealand was 2 small splashes at the bottom of the Pacific. Clearly, magic was imminent. There were going to be palm trees, dolphins, smiling natives. New Zealand was going to be just like my illustrated edition of Robinson Crusoe. We waved goodbye to everyone we knew, crossed the timeline on a one-way ticket, and arrived at the bottom of the South Island with a container full of books and a piano. The news hit us instantly. This was not the tropics. It was actually snowing. And the people looked like sunburned Scots. We were at the end of the world. For years, we huddled together and just got on with the business of survival, as emigrant families always do. And yet something was missing. It was as if we'd stepped off a cliff and were floating in some Pacific Ocean-carpeted waiting room to the afterworld. Through my late teens and 20s, I wrestled with the feeling that my real life was unfolding elsewhere. Far from here. Suddenly severed from my past, I felt unable to construct a future. Cut off from my mother tongue, I was beginning to write in a language and literary tradition that was alien to me. In my unseemly haste, I became stuck between languages. I had let go of Bulgarian, but I couldn't really go anywhere in English. I became speechless. In other words, I entered the transitional muteness of the immigrant that Eva Hoffman describes so well in her memoir, Lost in Translation. If language is your main means of expression, losing language means to lose yourself, to become invisible, to enter a liminal state of near vanishing. There I was, in the world's most beautiful landscape and most welcoming culture, and I had to take a pill to feel better. Around that time, I met a psychologist and mentioned my Antipodean alienation, to which he responded by quoting a man in Argentina with chronic depression. "I was born in Argentina," said the man, "but when I look at the pampa, I feel a chilling emptiness. I feel like this is not my landscape, like I don't know who I am here." This is what the man said. Some psychologists believe that depression is the manifestation of a spiritual problem of belonging, which might well be the problem of home. And so I moved from Dunedin to Wellington to Auckland, longing to feel part of something, of some landscape. But that something remained in my head. In Tahiti, where I spent a month on a university scholarship, I found myself swimming further and further from the beach. One afternoon, I swam so far that I lost sight of the shore. I could see the triangles of sharks' fins ahead. They came out at dusk. Perhaps I was on a swimmer's high, but my deep desire was to keep going until I met my destiny, whatever that was. I felt more connected with the water than with the land. This is what living in the Pacific was for me, a death wish on hold. I didn't know how to fix it, except, as ever, by running away. In Marseille the following year, I lived by the sea and wrote my first novel. It was set in Bulgaria and New Zealand, and of course it was raw and angry about both places. Something strange was happening. I was discovering the imaginative pull of distance, but this time as a writer. The further away I was from a place, the more real it became, and the urge to write it into being overrode the urge to live in the present. Even if something in me, the old grubby part of my soul perhaps, was plugged straight into Marseille with her shambolic Arab markets and foreign legionnaires with unhappy eyes. Then my visa expired and I returned to New Zealand, already plotting my next escape. For a while, I spent my days inside a bare rented room, surrounded by maps of the Mediterranean. I was living in a continuous state of internal emigration. Scotland, 10 years ago, was a kind of blind date. My happiness was instant, like a destiny fulfilled. I loved the way Edinburgh's chimneys cast shadows on sunny afternoons, the way buildings were made to precede you and outlive you while housing you, as if you too will live forever. I loved the cemeteries bumpy with centuries of flesh, the way locals asked, "Where do you stay?" as if they understand that nothing is permanent, the worn stone steps that lead to unexpected passages of time. In Scotland, I felt far from the concrete balcony of my childhood, but not so far that I felt removed from myself. "Home is where they understand you," said the writer Christian Morgenson. Here, beyond words, I felt understood. You need space to house your past as well as your future, and today I live in the Highlands. Why do I feel at home in this wilderness of giant hills that speak of distant devastation, where the sky moves every second and there are sudden fields of purple and the sheep are scattered like tombs? The wind seems to have a voice I understand, and the stone houses grow from the land, as if I already carried an imprint of this ancient human landscape. Here were the changing colours of my childhood seasons, the blue line of the sea ahead, like a promise, the stoical faces. It's as if this place is the northern continuation of my southern European self. In this haunted landscape, rich with the ruins of the human story, I feel geographically complete. The Jesuit philosopher Michel de Certeau said it in fewer words. He said, "Haunted places are the only ones people can live in." Happy endings are all very well, but what happens to the imagination when the spirit stops flickering like the needle of a broken compass? You go inwards more than you go outwards, and the nature of your inquiry changes. I now know that the practice of internal emigration, when there is clearly no need to emigrate further, is simply called being a writer. something else I know. Home is not the place you come from, but the place you reach. Home is not just the place where they understand you, but the place where you begin to understand yourself.
That was Kapka Kasabova, recorded by Kona McPhee. You can read more about Kapka on her website at www.kapka-kasabova.com. Kapka and Kasabova, both spelt with a K. And that concludes episode 18, which was produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 19, guest interviewer George Miller speaks with the travel writer Jeremy Seal about his fascination with Turkey. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.